Guys, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Larkin, Judge Schmidt, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is January 30th, 2025. This panel of the court today has four cases set for oral argument. The first case now. The first case for oral argument is case number A24-1082. Arianna Anderson and others versus City of Minneapolis. I believe counsel are familiar with our standard procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant will have an opportunity for rebuttal argument of 5 minutes. Our lectern is adjustable. There are some buttons on the front edge where you can move it up or down as you wish. And when you approach and begin, please state your name and the name of your client or clients, and then you may begin.
All right, good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Ben Kappelman for appellants, plaintiffs below. A decision affirming the district court will mean that Minnesotans aggrieved by racial discrimination will have no judicial recourse unless they can plead at the pleading stage that they were subjected to explicit overt racial discrimination of the type that, although far too common in our current society, is by no means the only type of discrimination from which they are entitled to be protected under Minnesota statute and the Minnesota Constitution.
Where in your complaint did you allege that these are members of protected class?
Oh, Your Honor, that's a red herring for three reasons, and I want to talk about why. First, the complaint repeatedly says that this is an action seeking redress for race-based discrimination. For example, paragraph 74, quote, the city prioritizes the well-being of the affluent and whiter wards of South Minneapolis over the lower income and blacker wards of North Minneapolis, thus discriminating by race and color for the full utilization or benefit of the inspection services public service. We also cite authority in our brief, Minneapolis versus State, a Supreme Court decision from 1981, recognizing the doctrine of associational discrimination in the context of public service discrimination under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And that is the doctrine that an individual subjected to discrimination based on their association with someone who is a member of a protected class has a claim. And finally, Your Honor, as the district court recognized, one of the named plaintiffs is a prominent African-American member of the Minneapolis community that was well known to the district court. So there is no pleading defect here, but even if there was, it was cured below.
You can't take judicial notice of, I know this person, and I know that person's black, but it's not in the pleading.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. I think that's exactly what the district court did.
Well, I know that's what the district court did. I'm saying I don't think you can do that. Like, why? Where's a case that says you can take judicial notice of someone's race when it's not in the pleading?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's right in the evidentiary rule for judicial notice. Is it the sort of fact that is well known within the community? And that's exactly what the district court said.
Did the district court go through the process required by Rule 201 to give the parties an opportunity to respond?
It did. I mean, the district court raised this at oral argument, and the city did not dispute the racial identity of Don Samuels, a member of the city council for a 9-year period and a member of the Minneapolis Board of Education for 4 years.
But is it in your pleading that Don Samuels was discriminated because of his race?
Yes, all of the plaintiffs were discriminated against because of their race. That's what the complaint alleges.
Well, it seems to me you're alleging claims that have socioeconomic type of basis for your claims, that there's discrimination based on, because it's North Minneapolis versus other areas of Minneapolis getting inspections. But there's nothing, I didn't see anything in your complaint that says these named plaintiffs are members of protected classes or that they're being discriminated based on their race.
So the complaint clearly says that this neighborhood is being discriminated against because of its racial makeup. That's explicit throughout. And when we look at the question of whether there's a pleading defect in not identifying the racial backgrounds of the individual plaintiffs in the complaint, we turn to the U.S. Bank versus Wall standard that the Supreme Court imposed about 10 years ago. And as I know the court is well familiar, the question under that test is whether there are facts that could be alleged consistent with the pleader's theory of relief that would entitle that plaintiff to recover. And so the question, if the court is concerned about this as a pleading defect, is, are there facts that could be alleged about these plaintiffs, such as their racial identities, that would entitle them to relief if that were required? And the answer is yes. Your Honors, the district court made two core errors below. First, holding that official immunity bars plaintiffs' claims for equitable relief. And second, dismissing appellant's equal protection claim. In addition, the city invites this court to make a third error, accepting the city's self-serving factual narrative instead of construing the pleadings in favor of appellants as Rule 12 requires. I know the court is clearly familiar with the background and the allegations in this case, but there are a few things I would like to highlight factually. Just like the neighborhood that they represent, appellants have a variety of backgrounds, living situations, and experiences with the city of Minneapolis. What they have in common is the financial, physical, and emotional injuries the city caused by discriminating against their neighborhood in the enforcement of its housing code. There are two aspects of the city's enforcement regime that are at issue. First, its assignment of housing inspectors based on population instead of complaint volume. And second, its failure to enforce the housing code in North Minneapolis.
And these are discretionary level decisions of the city, right?
No, Your Honor, I disagree with that.
Why?
Because there are aspects of the city's enforcement that do not even meet its ministerial obligations to follow its own laws. And the examples that are in the complaint include the allegations from individual plaintiffs that they have made repeated complaints to the city and seen no action result. There are also detailed descriptions in the complaint about how when the city shows up, it does nothing. And so, for example, plaintiff Ariana Anderson, a mother of five who lived in a Minneapolis rental, complained to the city asking them to test her apartment for lead because of those young children in the home. And the inspector showed up and told her, after testing one wall, that he knew her landlord. That landlord was, quote, a super good guy, and he would not allow lead to persist in that rental. Lo and behold, several years later, another inspector came, and the apartment did test positive for lead. How terrifying for Ms. Anderson to have been raising young children in that environment. Could a fact finder conclude that the city failed to meet even its ministerial duty to respond to her complaint of lead in the home? Yes, absolutely. A fact finder could do so.
But in terms of how inspectors are allocated throughout the city, which seems to be the gravamen of the complaint here, why is that not a discretionary decision that you're challenging?
The assignment of the housing inspectors has aspects of discretionary decision making, but as we discuss in regards to the official immunity doctrine, there is no immunity that shields the city from liability for declaratory and injunctive relief when that discretion is applied in a racially discriminatory manner. And so even if there is an element of discretion here, the claims still proceed because that discretion does not shield the city from injunctive and declaratory relief.
My understanding is that that argument is limited to the city's assertion of official immunity. Or, in other words, or that we must analyze them separately. In other words, correct me if I'm wrong, city asserted two types of immunity, right? Statutory / discretionary on the one hand, official immunity on the other. District court said that official immunity does not apply to claims of equitable relief. But the district court said, but we have to analyze those separately, right?
Correct, Judge Johnson. The district court imported concepts of statutory immunity to its official immunity analysis, which was a large source of the erroneous interpretation of the official immunity doctrine. But really, the statutory immunity doctrine is not applicable here at all. It's not applicable to the MHRA claim. It certainly isn't applicable to the constitutional claim. And so although the court, I assume,
but
will...
I think you say that because of the way you analyze the substance of the immunity or the case law about... I mean, I guess the district court had more of a categorical threshold reason for not applying official immunity. And our review is de novo. We can, if the district court's analysis was flawed in some way, we can always do it the right way. But I guess, do you agree with me that these are two separate questions, whether official immunity applies to equitable claims and whether statutory immunity applies to equitable claims?
They are separate questions, yes, Your Honor.
And on the statutory claim, district court said that the statute is unqualified, any claim. Are you arguing that was error?
Yes, Your Honor. It was error to import that concept into an official immunity analysis.
But what about
yes.
just with, I mean, by itself, was that statement or reasoning error with respect to the assertion of statutory immunity?
Yes, Your Honor, because it's out of context. So the whole genesis of statutory immunity is the waiver of sovereign immunity to permit tort claims. So to then focus on the definition of discretionary in the statute without acknowledging that those claims only arise in a tort claim for damages is to miss the mark on how that statutory immunity should be applied. But as I mentioned, that doctrine also doesn't apply to the claims that are at issue. So that's really the end of what should be this court's analysis of the statutory immunity doctrine. We've discussed the official immunity doctrine, Your Honor, and we've cited abundant authority in our brief explaining why the official immunity doctrine does not shield a government actor from prospective injunctive relief. All of the cases that discuss this issue refer to application of the official immunity doctrine to claims for damages. We cite the Simmons versus Fabian decision, which is analyzing a slightly different doctrine, but I think the detailed analysis and explanation of why this type of immunity exists is very on point for this court's analysis. And as that case explains, injunctions against discrimination do not interfere with permissible discretion because they simply prohibit government actors from doing what they had no legal right to do in the first place.
But and here you would be asking to reallocate how inspectors are sent out in the city. That seems to be attacking on a pure discretionary decision that may not have any basis on race. It's just, I'm... population here, population there, we're sending our inspectors out. So you'd be essentially rewriting how the city sends out their inspectors. That sort of concept of rewriting how the city does something on a discretionary level seems problematic. You're doing it through an injunction versus doing it through money damages. Why wouldn't the immunity doctrine protect both?
Well, Your Honor, because there is no immunity to discriminate.
Well, right, but I'm saying just on the very basis level of population inspectors. Like, that's it. That's how we're going to figure out our inspectors. And you're saying just on the basic level, that in itself is discriminatory?
Much later in this case, when a trial court is determining a remedy for discrimination that it has found, certainly the nuance of an appropriate solution would be addressed at that time. I think perhaps an analogy illustrates this point better, which is if 80% of the fires were in one neighborhood of a city, and yet the city insisted on spreading its fire trucks evenly across its population, if that neighborhood where the fires were happening was minority-majority, no one would question the ability of courts to redress that discrimination. And that is what is happening here in the context of housing inspection, both assignment of inspectors and in the manner that the housing code is enforced. The lackluster efforts, the marking complaints as resolved when they are not, the statistics that show that in order for the city to be resolving housing complaints at the approximately even 85% level that it claims, its inspectors in North Minneapolis would have to be 9 times as effective at doing their job as the inspectors in the rest of the city. There is more than enough evidence in this complaint to survive the Rule 12 motion. And it was the district court's error to grant that, and that's what this court should correct. I want to touch briefly on the MHRA claim and the application of the official immunity doctrine to that claim. First, we know from the text of the public service discrimination statute that it reads that it is unfair discriminatory practice to discriminate in the, quote, access to, admission to, or full utilization or benefit from any public service. And that effects-based language has been repeatedly found to permit the sort of claim for invidious discrimination that the plaintiffs are pressing in this case. And so another way that this case can be resolved that acknowledges the official immunity doctrine and yet recognizes the legislature's instruction to permit statutory discrimination claims is to recognize that the disparate impact theory of discrimination is alive and well both under the MHRA and under the Minnesota Constitution's equal protection doctrine.
But the Beaulieu case of the Minnesota Supreme Court is quite broad. There's not language saying this is only disparate treatment. It says MHRA, immunity applies.
So respectfully, Your Honor, I would again quibble with the language of quite broad because the decision says the opposite. So the Beaulieu decision disavows the sweeping effect that the city claims that it has. That decision says that, quote, the practical impact of Beaulieu will be, quote, at most negligible, that the court can think of few circumstances where its decision would apply. And so for the Supreme Court, in a case that's not about disparate impact, to have been foreclosing an entire doctrine of anti-discrimination law and labeling it at most negligible suggests that was not the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kappelman. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may approach and begin.
May it please the court. My name is Manessa Humayu, and I represent the City of Minneapolis, the respondent in this appeal. Your Honors, we ask that you affirm the district court's dismissal of all claims. I'm going to briefly address each of the counts that are still at issue. Count one, the MHRA claim is barred by official immunity, and because plaintiff appellants failed to state a claim for either disparate treatment or disparate impact, which is not a cognizable claim under the MHRA public services provision. Count two, breach of duty to enforce the housing code, is barred by both official and statutory immunities, and I'll address why official immunity applies, despite this being a claim only for equitable relief and not for money damages. The private AG statute claim, which was count three, was not appealed, and that claim has been lost and abandoned. And the final count, the equal protection claim, fails because, as the district court correctly noted, plaintiffs have asserted only a disparate impact treatment, or disparate impact claim under equal protection, and they fail to adequately plead it. I'll start with the official immunity question, Your Honor. Appellants misunderstand the official immunity doctrine's raison d'etre when they argue that official immunity cannot be asserted as a defense to an equitable relief claim only. The reason that Minnesota courts adopted the official immunity doctrine was to allow government officials to exercise their independent professional judgment in the performance of their discretionary duties to allow government to function smoothly without fear of costly litigation. Minnesota courts have repeatedly emphasized that official immunity is not just immunity from liability, it's immunity from suit altogether. And that is why the courts allow interlocutory appeals from denials of official immunity. That is why the courts have repeatedly said that official immunity must be decided at the earliest stage in the litigation possible, because it is supposed to protect officials not just from the verdict of money damages at the end of litigation, but from the burden of shouldering the costly discovery and the cost of litigation itself.
But does that case law say that, with respect to suit, and I'm familiar with that case law, can that be read to say that to be immune from suit on a claim for damages, as you know, and limited to that as opposed to any suit?
There are some cases that address, that use that language, Your Honor, but those are cases that address suits for damages only. There are some cases, as we cited in our briefs, that involve only claims for injunctive relief or declaratory relief, where this court has analyzed whether official immunity could apply by looking at whether the conduct at issue was ministerial or discretionary. And so there is no Minnesota appellate case that we have found that explicitly holds that official immunity may not be asserted as a defense in a claim where only equitable relief is sought. And I'll also point out that liability does not just encompass damages. Liability can also be liability for attorney's fees. So with an MHRA claim, there is the potential for a plaintiff to recover attorney's fees if the plaintiff prevails on the merits. And as we all know, in litigation, often attorney's fees can well exceed the plaintiff's ultimate recovery in money damages. And so again, we come back to that deterrence that official immunity is designed to prevent against. Official immunity is designed to allow government officials to do their jobs without the fear of that liability hanging over their heads every time they exercise discretion in a job function, the potential that they could be sued and have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in attorney's fees, in litigation costs to go through litigation, in the end maybe vindicated, not pay any damages, not have an adverse judgment against them, but still haven't shouldered all that expense.
It seems to me that this issue of whether official immunity applies to equitable claims strikes me that it's an unsettled issue, and that for the court to resolve it accurately would require a deep dive into case law going back a long way. I feel like it'd be an afternoon in the law library, maybe more than an afternoon, and so on. Must the court decide that issue? In other words, must we confront it? Is there an analytical path where it becomes not relevant?
Certainly, Your Honor. There are alternative grounds for affirming the district court's order on all counts. So with respect to the MHRA claim, there is the statutory immunity, with respect to MHRA, there is the failure to plead a prima facie case of disparate treatment and the issue of there not being a cognizable claim of disparate impact under the public services discrimination provision of the MHRA. The cases that we have cited to with respect to disparate impact under MHRA public services make it clear that this court, the Minnesota courts have not recognized a disparate impact claim under the public services provision. And when you look at the nature of public services decision making, it becomes pretty clear why that is. We pointed out the nature of the nature and extent of the variables that a government entity can and may consider and probably should consider when making decisions about how to allocate resources. And when you start down the path of allowing plaintiffs to bring disparate impact claims without any discriminatory motive on public services discrimination, under the public services discrimination provision, that really opens the door to the courts stepping into the executive branch discretionary decision-making functions of government officials.
Does the Supreme Court's decision in Bolio address the disparate impact? Is it broad enough to, does it cover all MHRA claims, or is it just disparate treatment?
I think it covers all the MHRA claims, Your Honor, and I'm glad you pointed that out, because Bolio was decided long after the Khalifa case, which appellants rely on for their argument that disparate impact is a cognizable claim under the MHRA public services provision. But Bolio really is the case that takes the most extensive, in-depth look at whether official immunity can apply under MHRA claims. And in reaching the conclusion that official immunity applies to MHRA, the court says the MHRA doesn't abrogate official immunity because you still have that ability to hold officials accountable when they violate the MHRA through this malice escape hatch. So anytime an official acts with malice or with willful or objective knowledge that the action that they're taking is unlawful, that would be synonymous with a violation of the MHRA, which really means that if you're acting with malice, you're committing an act that is disparate treatment under the MHRA, meaning you're motivated by a discriminatory motive that is unlawful. You don't get malice with unintentional, facially neutral, disparate impact type claims. So certainly the Bolio court was aware of the availability of disparate impact and disparate treatment claims generally under anti-discrimination statutes in general, but it did not say that disparate impact was available under the MHRA, and instead it said official immunity applies under MHRA. And I think the necessary conclusion from Bolio is that, one, yes, official immunity does apply under MHRA, and MHRA public services provisions, at least, only allow for disparate treatment claims, not disparate impact ones.
Ms. Humayun, you've, I think, said that both the statutory MHRA claim and the constitutional equal protection claim were not adequately pleaded. If that were the disposition of either the district court order or our decision, would that mean that the claims are dismissed without prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that would be the case. I will point out that after the city filed its motion to dismiss, plaintiffs had the opportunity to seek leave of the district court to amend the complaint, and they chose not to do that. And instead, they've tried to assert new allegations that don't appear anywhere in the complaint. I will address the equal protection issue briefly.
Can I go back one more follow-up?
Sure.
Did the district court address that with specificity, whether the claims, I mean, the one-page order says plaintiff's complaint is dismissed. It doesn't say with or without prejudice. Is there somewhere else in the order where that was addressed?
I believe, Your Honor, that in the absence of language that says it's without prejudice, the presumption would be that it is with prejudice.
Okay.
With regard to equal protection, plaintiffs seem to conflate disparate impact with disparate treatment. The crux of their equal protection claim, the factual crux, is the policy that they allege the city has of assigning housing inspectors based on population alone. And they acknowledge at various points that that is a disparate impact effects-based type claim. They acknowledge that in their brief at certain points, but then they fall back on the argument that it also somehow counts as a disparate impact or a disparate treatment claim, excuse me. For disparate impact, though, the fatal problem with appellant's argument is that they never pleaded discriminatory intent by the city to discriminate based on suspect class. And they try to get around that on appeal by citing to State v. Russell. And I don't think State v. Russell helps them because State v. Russell is distinguishable from our case. In State v. Russell, you had a statute that made a facial distinction, a facial classification between users of crack cocaine and users of powder cocaine, different penalties for the two. Here we have a facially neutral policy, as alleged in the complaint, that makes no classification of that sort. There is no distinction. Everybody's treated the same, regardless of where you live in Minneapolis, regardless of your race, regardless of your socioeconomic status. The city will assign inspectors based on the number of residents in your area. And there is a case that I found that I apologize, we did not cite in our brief, but I'm happy to provide a supplemental citation to the court after today's and to counsel after the oral argument today. This was a 2014 decision by this court. I believe, Judge Larkin, you wrote the opinion. It was Dean versus City of Winona, 843 Northwest 2nd, 249. And that case involved a policy or ordinance that was much more similar to the one at issue here, and the court distinguished it from Russell. So in Dean versus City of Winona, the court was looking at a city ordinance that limited or capped at 30% the number of units on any city block that would be eligible for rental licenses. And there was an equal protection challenge brought, and the court rejected the equal protection argument, saying that there was no classification there. There was no distinction, unlike in Russell, that would allow the court to proceed to the kind of rational basis examination that the court undertook in Russell. How do you do a rational basis examination of what the purpose of classification is when there is no classification to begin with? So I think that's a problem that appellants are facing on their equal protection claim when it comes to their disparate impact claim. And I see I have 48
seconds. How do you respond to your opposing counsel's hypothetical where 80% of the fires in the city exist in one area that is predominantly BIPOC community, but the fire trucks are allocated throughout the entire city? Wouldn't that be, from a policy level, discriminatory?
From a policy level, perhaps, Your Honor, but for an equal protection analysis, I think you would still need some sort of a facial classification or intent. And I think there's also the problem of there being nothing in the complaint that identifies any similarly situated group of people. And I apologize, I'm out of time, if I have permission of the court to continue.
Oh, yeah, please complete your answer.
There is no identification in the complaint of any group of people who are similarly situated as plaintiffs who are treated differently. So there are quite a few allegations in the complaint about housing inspectors' interactions with some of the plaintiffs, how the plaintiffs experienced the response from the housing inspectors. But there's no allegation about South Minneapolis or predominantly white neighborhood residents' experiences with housing inspectors. There's nothing in the complaint that says housing inspectors resolved more effectively or more quickly the complaints from white residents or from more affluent neighborhoods. And to respond to one more point that opposing counsel made that's related to this, the MHRA doesn't protect neighborhoods. It protects individuals from discrimination. And I think that's, again, where the claims fail, because repeatedly we're back to there's no allegation of membership in a protected class for purposes of MHRA. There's no similarly situated group identified for purposes of equal protection. And that is why all of those claims would fail. So with that, I would ask that you affirm the district court. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Himayan. Mr. Kaplan, you have an opportunity for rebuttal. And I'd like to, at the outset, just confirm, clarify in my own mind. Ms. Himayan identified the four causes of action, 1, 2, 3, 4. Am I correct that only 1 and 4 are at issue on appeal?
I would say the count 2 is also still alive. There was discussion of that in the response brief and the reply brief, but certainly the focus.
Well, I'm looking at your opening brief. I'm not clear where in the issues raised in your opening brief you've challenged the district court's ruling on count 2.
So the only basis that the district court used to dismiss count 2 was official immunity, and so that's where we've addressed it, is with our explanation for why official immunity doesn't bar any of the claims.
Ms. Himayan said, I believe she said it's also, district court said it's also barred by statutory immunity.
I don't believe the district court went that far. The district court had an extensive discussion of whether there was a special duty and found that, at least for pleading purposes, there was, and then turned to the official immunity doctrine. So that's at least how I read the decision below.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I want to start with a point that was made about the pleading of really both discrimination claims and where are the similarly situated individuals who are getting better services. And that's right in paragraphs 11 and 12 of the complaint, where we discuss how wards 11, 12, and 13 in Minneapolis, which are non-BIPOC majority neighborhoods, receive 28% of the city's housing inspectors, despite there only being 5% of the complaints emanating from those neighborhoods. And as I discussed earlier, that is the crux of the assignment portion of this discrimination claim, that those non-BIPOC neighborhoods are getting better services from the city because they're getting more resources from the city, and that discriminatory conduct is redressable.
I'm going to stop you. I have a question about that as well. In your reply brief, excuse me, why don't you proceed? I'll review and perhaps ask that question later.
I actually have a follow-up question to Judge Johnson's first question, which is on your counts. The count three with section 831, that doesn't appear to be before us.
Yes, the private AG is dropped. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So I want to back up to the distinction that is being drawn between the disparate treatment and the disparate impact theories of discrimination. And importantly, the complaint simply pleads discrimination, of which there can be two varieties, as we've discussed at length. And that's all that Minnesota pleading standards require. We've cited authority in our brief explaining that plaintiffs are not required to elect as between disparate treatment and disparate impact at the pleading stage. And the reason for that is an important one. As the U.S. Supreme Court explained in the Arlington Heights decision in the 1970s, sometimes the first and best evidence of disparate treatment is disparate impact. And so, jumping back to the Walsh standard, given the disparate impact, could facts be adduced in discovery showing that that impact is the result of disparate treatment, of intentional discrimination? Yes, they absolutely could. And that's exactly why we are able to plead both disparate treatment and disparate impact in the complaint.
I've now identified my question. So in the city's responsive brief, they have a different view of the facts, I believe. But it seems like the city is relying on exhibits to your complaint. And then in your reply brief, I think you respond. So, I mean, we're in a little bit of normally in a Rule 12 motion dismiss, we just read the complaint or the exhibits to the complaint, and usually we take the allegations, assume them to be true on their face. But I don't know, is that different in this case? And should we apply the Rule 12 standard of review, or do we treat this like a summary judgment motion in some way? Whether overtly or kind of de facto sense within our Rule 12 review, do we somehow take the allegations? I'm not sure how we construe your allegations in light of these disputes in the briefs about the facts.
Yes, so actually, I think the answer is clear. The court should follow the Rule 12 standard. So below, the complaint had exhibits. The city offered competing exhibits in its motion to dismiss. I think with one exception, we objected. And the district court said it was not considering that additional evidence, i.e., it was not going to convert this Rule 12 motion into a Rule 56 motion. Now, if it had wanted to do so, the district court would have given notice, and then it would have had to turn to the Rule 56.04 declaration that we had filed, explaining the discovery that needed to occur before a summary judgment decision could be rendered. And so, for this court's purposes, the Rule 12 standard should apply. It's the complaint, it's the exhibits to the complaint, and that's the extent of the record.
So, okay, that makes me wonder, the city's statement of facts in their responsive appellant brief, are those statements confined to your exhibits, or is the city relying on their own exhibits when making those statements?
No, so the city is relying on its own exhibits, and it's actually going further and just pulling information from its own databases, its dashboard, to present to this court for the first time. And so not only is it outside the Rule 12 record, it's outside the appellate record, and there's just no basis to consider all of those fact disputes. If anything, it highlights how many fact disputes need to be resolved in order for the discrimination that plaintiffs are complaining of to be resolved in the courts as it should.
That helps. I've used up a lot of your time, and so if there was something that you were intending to cover and you think it's important, go ahead and take additional time.
With your indulgence, Your Honor, I'll make one more point, which is that the way that the city is arguing the official immunity doctrine should apply would be to make it even more expansive than absolute judicial immunity. As Judge Wright explains in the Simmons decision, even judges are subject to an injunction. Ex parte Young has held that that's the case for centuries. And so to interpret, as the city wishes, the official immunity doctrine to bar any judicial relief would simply be inconsistent with that centuries of precedent. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days. Counsel in the second case may come forward and get ready for their arguments. I was going to note that the lectern is adjustable. It looks like you found the buttons. And so both attorneys may feel free to adjust it as you wish.